what makes me happy, you curious, you courageous hurly-burlyites? You can probably guess a couple of things, but let's go over the three R's of hurly happiness. The first R is rum, entirely predictable, eh? The second R is riders. Ronnie, George, Bobby Thompson, and Rhett Dawson, and Kent Austin, and on through the years, ever since the late 60s when I first fell in love with football. Rum's only been in my blood since 1974. If you do the math again, I think I was 12 when I had my first rum and coke, and that would have been at my brother's wedding. The third R is newer, but just as meaningful to me. It's having a returning guest on the Hurly Burly, because it means the conversation was a great one, and there's still more to explore. That's absolutely the case today. Armin Yelnesian is here on the pod for the second time. Her first appearance was in May 2022, middle of COVID. Armin is a leading voice on Canada's economy. According to Maclean's magazine, she's the caring person's economist, a big picture thinker who looks out for the little guy, the coiner of the term she session way back in March 2020 to describe the economic fallout of the pandemic. Armin is currently the Atkinson Fellow on the Future of Workers. Her mission is to bring a worker's perspective to the public policy development process and to help all of us make sense of what's happening in the economy. Today, we'll continue our conversation on Canada's care economy. Armin's been doing a lot of work in long-term care, and we'll dive into that. But we'll also talk about the other flood of new social programs that appear to be on the table in recent days and where that's all taking us. So, Armin, all I can say is thank you for doing this. It's such a great pleasure to have you back on the show.
And all I can say is thank you for bringing me back, because I had so much fun the last time we did this.
Okay, well, let's do that again. You know, I got to start with, I saw on social media that you noted the passing of Daniel Kahneman.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that? What does Daniel Kahneman mean to you?
There's very few economists that can talk to us about how we think about the world. Adam Smith was one. And he based it on a theory of moral sentiment, not on marginal theories. When I was first studying economics, Albert Hirschman was another one. Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, bringing real clarity to the fact that people aren't just individual transaction agents, that we are located in institutions, and we have choices on whether we stay in that institution, we go in the institution, or we speak up in the institution. And Daniel Kahneman was the latest contribution in my worldview to examining how we decide things work. And, you know, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, Malcolm Gladwell had the book Blink about how fast we think. Well, Daniel Kahneman's work was kind of the balance to that. Yes, we all do blink thinking, where we're thinking fast. But in fact, fast thinking often works against our self-interest. And he was talking about how difficult it is to be homo economicus, which is the rational economic agent that we have been taught for my entire life as an economist, is the norm, is the unit of analysis, is the unit of decision making. People aren't rational. And we're seeing this more and more now on stilts, right? That a lot of the decision making that's made in the name of economics is actually appealing to tribal interests, into self-interest, but in a really collective way, oddly, sometimes doesn't make sense from either party's point of view. Somebody might take a look at public policies and say, but how are you going to pay for that? And, you know, debt is the monster that we're passing on to our kids. That whole analysis goes directly against we need to invest now to prevent costs down the road, which is a very grandma an ounce of prevention will be worth a pound of cure. So very different ways of looking at the world. And I just loved his book and what it brought to my, you know, I'm a bit of a dark horse in the Canadian economic scene. And so it brought me some sense of stability that what I was saying had massive behavioral economics backing.
Daniel Kahneman depressed the hell out of me.
Yeah. Why?
Because I read Thinking Fast and Slow in my 50s. And I realized that two things happened. One of which is I realized that I had spent like 25 years doing communications wrong. That he just explained a whole bunch of things to me that I needed to know in my 30s. but didn't know until my 50s. So I was depressed about that. But the second thing is I read his book and I read Sapiens around the same time. And between the two books, they basically made me give up on humanity because Thinking Fast and Slow says that we make the vast majority of our decisions instinctively based on very, very limited information and stick to those decisions unless we're really forced to reassess them. And Sapiens told me that the brains that are making those quick decisions have not evolved at all from the time that we were wandering around the jungle with spears, killing whatever we ran into. So the notion that we are condemned to make snap decisions based on faulty programming is kind of depressing.
Except Kahneman also points out that, yes, we can make slow thought. Yes, we can be self-reflective. And that we should actually permit ourselves, we should forgive ourselves that we have both these capacities. And by being aware of them, move as often as we can to examining our gut instinct, which is often based on priors, you know, based on things that have happened to us in the past. It's fast thinking because it's fast neural networks. It's what happened to us as kids. This is the truth we understood as kids. This is patterns that have been long established. And once you understand that you are interrupting something, some knee-jerk reaction with what held in the past but might not be good for the moment or the future, it's a gift to be affirmed that, yeah, your brain works in different ways at different times. And
but he wanted us to conclude that we were mistaken far more often than humans like to concede that we are mistaken.
I think humans never like to concede that they are mistaken. I think humans love affirmation, which is the world that we are swimming in right now. People that are trying to affirm often our worst instincts to be able to make hay politically. And to your point, you wish that you had known it, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. I guess me too, in the sense that what I communicate about economics, I was communicating as if everybody understood what I was talking about it and why I was talking about it. And this reminded me, oh yeah, we all have our priors, you know, and you have to meet people where they're at. Mm. If you want to engage in a discussion that might yield fruit both ways, that we both learn from one another.
I had relied far too much before reading that book on rational reasoning processes in my communications and not enough on triggering the fast brain.
Yeah, and aren't we being forced? I mean, you more than I, well, maybe both of us in our own sphere of influence, but the idea that politics has become very fast right now, very fast thinking, and it's very gut. It's very not head. It's all. It's not even heart. It's gut. It's knee jerk. So I'm going below the belt here. But the idea that we're going from here to here, well, that sometimes is good, some mix of head and heart. But what we're being offered right now, largely, is gut from a very hard right populist movement. It is fear on both the hard left and on the hard right that people are getting sidelined. And in the middle is an extremely intellectual, policy-driven, you know, fact-driven, evidence-based retort, which isn't dealing with the reality of the emotional moment.
But I've heard, I mean, I heard David Plouffe, Obama's campaign manager, say recently that these days you pretty much have to start your communications with the meme and work your way backwards.
That's a really good line. And the meme is constant, like you don't have a meme of 5 years or 2 years or 1 year. The memes come and go, and you got to surf that baby. You got to bring it all the way into the beach.
Yep, absolutely. All right, let's talk some economics and some policy. Okay. So I want to get into some specific issues with you, but I want to start at kind of a high level with you. What do you think the Trudeau Liberals are up to with this seemingly very activist budget that they're signaling?
I think they've looked at the calendar and they have figured out this is their last chance to get Canadians to see that they may be the same government that they were at the beginning and then during the pandemic, and then they lost the plot. And it's an opportunity for them to say to Canadians, particularly the ones that got hardest hit during the pandemic. And because of the wave of inflation, we're here for you. And it's almost like throwing down the gauntlet to the other side to say, what would you do that's different? If you don't like our version of activism, what would you do? Would you do more of it, or would you do the opposite? It is starting a political conversation where it needs to start, at roughly the right point in the calendar to get actually decent debate as to what the choices are for people. So I think that's different from most budgets, because it's usually the budget that does it. But I think what the budget is going to give us is, how are you going to pay for that? Right. It's going to be actually the thing that budget should do, which is talking about, well, we're doing this and we're going to pay for it that way. And here's how we're dealing with deficit and debt. That should be the storyline of budget day. And the other thing is, here's our priorities. Leading up to the budget, here's where we're leaning in heavily with the power of government, which is what we are. We are the government. We can actually do things. Here's what we're planning on doing.
Right. Right. I get the sense you think it's kind of political desperation that has driven them to this point. Or are they just finding this is the time to do the shit we've wanted to do?
I think the last 2 years knocked everybody off their balance. I mean, let's be realistic. I have never served in a government. I have worked for a government on the public service side. They got elected, then had Trump on their doorstep, who went to tear up NAFTA, who was the most destabilizing force that we had ever had south of the border. Then we got, and they had a couple of good rounds of stuff in there to signal what they had wanted to do, but we kept getting knocked off track by external events. Then came the pandemic. The people that are in power now, many of them are the same people that were in power and delivering the goods through a polycrisis during the pandemic, and then inflation. And by the time we got to inflation, I think we had a government that was worried about losing their AAA rating, credit rating, which gave them the space to do a lot of debt-financed activity, which saved our bacon. People love to point to the United States being the fastest growing in the world right now. We were the fastest growing. When the global economy reopened, it was a program like CERB that nobody else did that permitted people to have the purchasing power to go out there and spend and watch the economy rebound. What we're seeing in the United States now is the dead cat bounce, right? Like it's growing faster because it didn't grow fast enough last year. So it's in comparison to last year that this growth.
But it's also being, if I could just, because it's relevant to later, isn't the United States also being fueled by massive government spending?
Oh, yeah, and huge debt. And people are still losing their minds that Canada needs to, live within its means and like pare down its debt. But like the federal government level of debt is the lowest in the G7 out of the 29 richest countries. We're the 11th lowest. We're on a great trajectory. We did just lose our AAA rating to Fitch, but the United States lost it a year ago in March of 2023. And we still have great credit rating. We've got the best credit rating of any of the rich countries still today. So what Minister Freeland doesn't want to have happen is if we're slowing down in our ability to balance the books, that means we're paying debt service, and we don't want the cost of that to go up. So that's the tightrope she has to walk, that a lot of people on the outside of government think, well, why aren't they doing this? Why aren't they doing that? It's like, if they cut spending too much, they slow growth even more. If they don't raise revenues or don't cut spending, the debt balloons because we're in a slow growth moment. So I personally would not want to be the Minister of Finance, though when I was younger, I thought that would be the coolest job in the world.
No. Yeah. Let me reassure you that you would want to be the Minister of Finance. You'd probably be very good at it. You'd like it. But in any event, we'll leave that for another day when I try to recruit you into politics.
Never happening.
A question for you loyal Hurly-Burlyites who tune in here every week. Did you ever think you'd absorb so many data points about CRTC hearings or the best way to wholesale wireline fiber to the premises so there's real sustainable competition out there between the companies who want to provide it to you? Yeah, me neither. But given the ubiquity of the internet, high-speed internet, all the critical stuff it does for us, and the price we pay for it, the whole topic is pretty germane, eh? Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, thinks so. TELUS started life as a regional copper telephone company. A few decades later, hard to argue they've been the most successful new entrant in the telecom industry. With a history of investing in the communities they serve, making bold, i.e. really big, investments to innovate their products and services and venture into new markets. Mobility, business solutions, home internet, security and home automation, TV, content and entertainment solutions, healthcare and agricultural solutions, TELUS accomplished all of this under the existing regulatory framework, expanding nationally west from BC to connect us. Short story is, they've got the bona fides to provide sustainable, innovative, and differentiated competition for more Canadians. That means more Eastern Canadians, Hurly-Burlyites. TELUS wants to expand eastward. They also believe in the virtue of investing in the communities they serve, which is why you heard them recommend a disaggregated mandate last week. Remember? Skin in the game. Building more connection points for home internet, increasing its reliability and security right across the country, and innovating new services with their keen focus on customer experience, new plans and bundles, new features and technologies, all of which pushes their competition in Ontario, Quebec, and everywhere else to improve their own offerings. Customers win either way. A specific example of one of those innovative products next week. So based on what you've seen so far in this pre-budget rollout, are they attacking the right things in the right way? What's your impression of this rollout?
I think the things that they are attacking is very good, like the array of things. I think the amount of money makes it like right direction, virtue signaling, right? We've got $1.5 billion to preserve existing affordable housing stock, right? The housing story is the story of this budget by and large. And that $1.5 billion, $1 billion is for loans, $500 million is for grants to nonprofits. It's like we could be building land trusts. You know how we did, like, somehow Michael Sabia found $80 billion over 10 years, right? He's taking advantage of some of it right now as we speak. But already we have spent $10 billion of public money, levered another $10 billion of private money, and that infrastructure, the infrastructure projects that have been thus financed are already starting to provide returns. We could do the same thing in housing. Absolutely, we could do the same thing in housing. We are not playing at a grand enough scale to make a difference. And for every unit of housing we built from 2011 to 2021, we lost 15 units. And it's been worse since inflation came to town. So we need to be doing something to preserve what we've got, not just build, build, build. We have to do more to actually deal with the math of this housing problem. Because if we don't, we're going to have even slower growth because the people just don't have enough spending money after most of their money goes to rent or mortgage.
Right. I mean, the housing file is, you know, it's a complex one. They've got a million different things on the go. Fraser's been very active. But I just want to put that aside for a second and talk about the more socially programmed side of it and take up your point about them, which is every one of these initiatives that I look at, childcare, dental care, pharma care, school food, it feels like small ball on all of those things in the sense that pharma covers two types of drugs. School food is for only 400,000 kids across the country. Childcare spaces are now affordable but unavailable. I mean, like $200 million a year for school food. I mean, $200 million a year in 1996 would have been a hell of an announceable. But for this government in 2024, that's kind of a rounding error, isn't it?
I couldn't agree with you more on the dollars and cents, and I've tried to do my best economics to say I understand why Freeland was Dr. No on doing more. Finance is always the department of no. But this one, you're balancing, you could be raising revenues. There are ways to raise revenues.
Let's get to that. Hold that thought. Let's get to that.
Yeah, they're always politically unpopular, right? Cuts are unpopular. More revenues are unpopular. Debt is unpopular. That's why it's very difficult to be a finance minister right now. But to your point about small ball, 100%. Right direction, not enough money. It's performance art at some level, which is why liberals have always called the NDP liberals in a hurry, right? Because when you're going to do something, will you please do it? So the NDP have pushed them on pharmacare and on dental care. I must say I hate both of their proposals, but it doesn't matter. The idea that people need those basics covered and there's somebody pushing them to do more than they were. They got it with childcare finally because it became an economic exigency rather than a social exigency. And now 2 years of inflation and elevated levels because prices aren't going down without wages catching up for many, many people means that they have to do something about affordability that decommodifies the things that people can't escape spending money on. So I think they're doing the right thing. I think this is the path forward, not a basic income, but actually take the things we need out of the market, grow that part of the market that is non-market, that is the things we need every day, elder care, health care, child care, dental care, mental health care, pharma care. It's the care economy is enormous and needs to get bigger right now, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's small ball the way they're doing it. However, you got to balance the books somehow. You got to signal that you are willing to not be a spendthrift, I guess. I guess that's the logic. And I have some, you know, as a single sole support mom of a woman who, my mother was a single sole support mom because my father died at a very young age. Like, you don't live beyond your means. I get it, right? You live within your means, but you do the right things. So, I mean, one could argue that the revenue side is what hasn't delivered lately. It might, because we're at $100 a barrel oil.
Right. Right. I mean, let's start with, to get to the fiscal side of this, let's start with acknowledging that you are on a bit of an island among your economist compatriots. Maybe Jim Stanford is on that island with you, maybe somebody else, but none of the bank economists are on that island with you, and none of the business economists are on that island with you. They're all decrying this spending. They're all saying it's wasteful, unproductive, it's consumption, not investment, and the government needs to show far more fiscal discipline than it has been showing. What's wrong with that thinking in the sense that surely one cannot, now that we know that modern monetary theory isn't going to happen for us, you can't obviously consume more than you raise on an ongoing basis. I mean, I'm sympathetic to this distinction between productive investment and income redistribution and consumption spending as being different things and of different characters in government spending. What do you think?
I want to go back to my colleagues on Bay Street and maybe the central bank, because it's been making some noises about this too. And just point out that none of them have wrapped their heads around the fact that we are in a new world, which is the world of demographics. Population aging is slowing economies in every country that had a baby boom after the Second World War and saw falling birth rates in the intervening 40, 50 years. And that means there is a drag on consumption, and household spending as a share of GDP is the main driver of any economy anywhere. Domestic spending by households is the main driver of GDP, but as a population gets older, they don't need to save or buy as many large capital things. They don't go, depending on how old they get, a larger share of people are not traveling, they're not buying clothes, they're not buying furniture, they're not going out even, right? So they're spending less.
They do buy more knees and hips.
Yeah, that's true. There you go. So what they buy, by and large, is healthcare.
Yeah.
Healthcare, elder care, home care. And then the smallest working age cohort we have seen since the 50s and 60s is now supporting the biggest population of people too old, too young, and too sick to work that we've seen in over half a century. And our background rate of growth is not 6%, 5 and 6%. It is 1 to 2%. So this generation of working aged people is going to have to do more heavy lifting than we have ever seen the labor market have to do. Normally, that would mean huge bargaining power. And normally, that would mean the people that make more pay more. But you've got this huge push to make sure that we're flooding the market with people that have no labor rights that they can exercise. These are temporary foreign workers and international students who are cheap labor. So we're offsetting the supply and demand by introducing a new source of supply that is really growing against the current of, but every country is doing exactly the same thing, right? It's a whole global north, global south thing. I guess what I want to say is that my colleagues are not seeing the big picture of how the global economy is changing. They're still in the more market, less government frame in an era where if you don't have more government, if you don't actually have more government, you're going to have more poor people, you're going to have more dead people, you're going to have more sicker, quicker people, and you are going to underinvest in that most precious of all resources, which is the youngest generation, well before they get into the workforce, that we are underinvesting in all the things that actually make us productive. So this whole productivity meme that's out there is like, what do you think happens if somebody is worried that they're going to lose their housing and they can't afford anything else that's in the market? What do you think is going to happen if I can't find a doctor and I feel like I don't know whether what I've got is a problem or something I should just sit at home and live with for a while? You're preoccupied all the time with these basics. I can't afford nutritious food. I'm constantly hungry. What do you think happens to a population where a growing share are considering how to deal with absolute basic problems? They can't be as productive. End of story. So if these guys on Bay Street and at the bank who can buy anything they want, wherever they want, never have experienced hunger, don't know anybody that is hungry, don't know anybody that is scared shitless of being rent evicted or evicted or losing their mortgage. If you don't know these people, you operate in your own bubble, you can easily say that's consumption. So then what happens if a government listens to those people who vote and say, yeah, we're actually going to help you? They are either going to have to do one of two things. They are either going to have to raise revenues from someplace, or they're going to have to do it through debt financing. Well, debt financing is not sustainable over the long run. You can do it for a while, but you can't do it forever. So at the end of the day, we are talking about raising revenues from somewhere.
Yeah. You know, helping marginalized people is a bad political bet because they don't vote in large numbers.
That is correct. And that's why we didn't have childcare also for 50 years. It did not pay off. The answer was, you're struggling now, but it'll be over when your kids go into school. There wasn't enough of a vote in it. I actually think the polls are showing that.
Right. Okay, but to go back to your point about we need to invest in these things and people need these things, but you can't be the tooth fairy, right? There is money and there are rules about money. So at 5% interest rates and at the economic growth rates we're anticipating, what level of annual deficit do you think is sustainable for us?
I mean, I don't know how to answer that because I think we're asking the wrong questions. What would be the deficit in 10 years if we didn't make these investments? It would be even slower growth, right? Like it is that grandma, like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We will be paying for this one way or another. The people on Bay Street and people that tend to be more conservative in their approach to government finances will say, but you can't pass on that debt to your children. You think you're not passing on a debt if you don't build enough housing, if you don't have enough education, you don't have enough healthcare. It's just a different form of debt. So, you know, it isn't as nicely measured as in one number what should be the debt or the deficit as a share of GDP. You're going to have some amount. But again, just to remind you, we're the best out of the G7 right now, and we're 11th out of the 29th richest countries, some of which are tax havens.
Right.
So,
but you can't really count the United States because they're so huge and they're the...
They're worse than us by a large margin.
But they're the reserve currency of the world, so it doesn't matter to them. They're not in our position.
It does matter to them. It does matter to them how sustainable their debt is. They are having the same conversations. And there, I would argue, it might be even more germane because the geopolitical world order is shifting. So they are the reserve currency now. Will they be the reserve currency in 10 years? You know, there are lots of things that are moving. So I think there's a lot of hubris saying they don't need to worry about it. And there's a lot of hubris saying that's the only thing we should be worrying about here. We have way bigger fish to fry in Canada than how big is our federal debt.
Right. What are the federal, but let's just stick with the FISC one last time.
You
bet. What are their revenue options?
You know that infrastructure bank that I talked about earlier? They've already deployed $10 billion of public funding in various infrastructure projects for energy, for transit across the country, and received leverage roughly $10 billion of private sector money, and those projects are paying returns already. So that's a way of, we could be doing the same thing in housing. That's a way of paying for itself, childcare itself, right? You do it properly and women work more. That's what we learned from Quebec, is it pays for itself because it encourages labor force, more labor force
hours. It absolutely
doesn't
pay for itself. I'm going to fight with you. It absolutely doesn't pay for itself, or Quebec would fund it better than it does. Like even in Quebec, you can't get spaces. If every space was an additional economic growth, governments would put shitloads of money into this thing.
Wrong. And my fighting back with you is it depends on who's in power. So that was a Parti Québécois initiative in 1997. The Liberals came in and opened the doors to for-profit care, which is the way they expanded. And it was shitty, shitty quality. And they didn't invest in the places where currently the federal money that Quebec is getting is going to the sources of childcare funding that, you know, they know they should have built. And this is the way you do fiscal federalism in this country, is you give Quebec something that it wants without strings attached. What does it do with it? It does what it should have been doing all along if it had only raised the money for it. But like, frankly, when I say it does pay for itself, Quebec might have reached some kind of plateau. But across the rest of the country, we're nowhere near that plateau.
Productivity is a topic nowadays. So let's look back at a pair of ferocious Canadian entrepreneurs who left a colossal legacy. In 1899, William Mackenzie and Donald Mann founded Canadian Northern Railway in Manitoba. They started with 100 miles of track between Lake Winnipeg and Thunder Bay, then known as Port Arthur and Fort William. They then proceeded to build and acquire relentlessly. By 1902, they had 2,500 miles of track from Rainy River in Ontario through Winnipeg and onward to Erwood in the then Northwest Territories. They called their method the pioneering system, which was a euphemism for building fast to minimum standards, keeping costs down, and pushing ahead. In 1903, the pair got into a storied race for the West Coast with a competitor. They made it to Edmonton 2 years later. By that time, they'd covered roughly half the country in 6 years. But building a railroad over the Rockies is something else. Slower and a lot more expensive. Mackenzie and Mann persevered, even though their competitor, Canadian Pacific, had the easier real estate on the eastern side of the Thompson and Fraser Rivers. Both railways made it to the coast, but by the time the last spike was driven in 1916, Mackenzie and Mann were groaning under debt, and Ottawa stepped in to take over Canadian Northern. The two men were knighted for their achievements, 100 miles to 10,000 miles of track spanning seven provinces built in 18 years. Talk about productivity. Much of that line remains as sections of our sponsors network, CN. But as much as Mackenzie and Mann were titans, they were men of their time. This is now. And now, safety is the prime directive at CN. Building past standards and pushing standards is the new deal. Oh, and I should mention, CN knows a thing or two about productivity too. There are rumors afoot that the government is going to bring in some sort of financial hit to high net worth or high income individuals in the
country. Awesome.
Right? And that's going to be both a revenue offset to their expenditures and a political wedge for them.
Tell me what you think about that.
Well, I'm always for it, even though it would affect me. I'm always for it. But I do remember the caution when Premier Wynne raised the provincial top bracket checks when she became premier. And I do remember that the bureaucrats told us that there had, following that, been significant action to avoid taxation in Ontario. That people of means had started to take more extraordinary action to avoid paying their Ontario taxes. So it brought tax avoidance along with it. So there was some theory that we've got that maxed out and that if we increase it more, we might actually get less because fewer people will pay. And capital's pretty mobile these days.
So that was income tax. It was an income surtax. And by the time, and it was only applicable to, I can't remember what the
250,000 or more.
Right. Okay. So it's the dollar you made over 250, and I can guarantee you there aren't a whole lot of people that are there, but the ones that are there, they've got lobbyists, they've got tax accountants, they've got ways of getting around it. I mean, there's also the capital side of things. Some people have made a killing in the last few years on capital gains. Right? There has been a lot of flipping of houses. And back in 1987, the Conservative government lowered the rate at which we taxed capital gains in an effort to spur investment. And investment never was spurred. So we get this, strike capital strike meme all the time. You tax me too much, I'll leave. You tax my capital too much, I'll leave. Fine, go, go to Chad, where there is almost no taxation. You want no taxation? Go. And in fact, even something as simple as Alberta, which introduced a flat tax on incomes in, I think, the year 2000, there wasn't huge capital flight to locate your household in Alberta. This is within Canada. People don't move. There's a lot of saber rattling that goes with I'm not going to pay. And there will be people that won't pay. 100% there will be. And there may be more tax avoidance than there was in the past, but you will also collect more revenue. That is also true. And then the flip side of this is if you don't make these expenditures that I have mentioned on non-market, pharma, dental, housing, childcare, if you don't decommodify this market, which is getting more and more expensive because there's more and more demand for it, you will have more people that are sicker quicker. You will have fewer people working because they can't find childcare. You will have more people that working age people have to take care of because there's no place to have them taken care of. So you are shooting yourself in the foot if you think you're going to get off scot-free because you're not spending. You will make more money. You might not cover all your costs, but you will make more money by doing this than by not doing it.
Okay.
The end.
The end. I read an article you wrote about productivity and about GDP per capita.
Yeah.
Now, I have talked to a lot of people about productivity in Canada, some on this pod and some off. There isn't anybody that I've talked to that doesn't think it's a real problem. I think there's lots of evidence that it's a Western world problem, not a Canada problem. But in that context, Canada still appears to be a relative laggard of our peers in productivity growth. The equation is pretty simple. If we want more stuff, we have to make more money. So if we want to have, for instance, more expensive social programs in this country that requires higher level of productivity in order to pay for that, is the basic equation, as I understand it. Or if we want higher incomes to offset the rise in food prices that has gone on, we need more productivity so that there can be higher incomes. And without that productivity, we can't expand our society in the ways I'm just talking about. Starting assumption to everybody that I've talked to, almost nobody has an answer for the why doesn't Canadian business invest the same as other countries. Nobody really has an answer to that or a prescription to how to fix that. But everybody includes fiscal discipline in their list of things that Canada should do to up its productivity. And I wonder whether, more broadly, are we in a situation where our social goals are in conflict with our economic imperatives?
I've got about five different streams of answers as you went through what you just said. I'm going to start with why is Canada's productivity lower than the United States? Historically, that wasn't true. Then it became true somewhere around the 70s and 80s. We've had periods where that gap has shrunk and then it has widened again. It's quite wide right now. The answer is, after the Second World War, both Canada and the United States went through the countries that were involved in the Second World War went through a process of converting the military industrial complex to a consumer industrial complex, which really required a lot of investment of capital, a lot of productivity, and a lot of growth. It was the holy trinity of what we are trying to get back to, which cannot happen unless you're reconstructing a whole economy. Cannot happen, but that is that's the golden age everybody points to. By the time we get to the 70s, they're investing less. We had become a branch plant economy in the course of the 60s and the early 70s. And once that investment had been made, there's Mexico on the other side, and free trade began. So one of the reasons why we had so much business investment was because it was American parent companies investing in Canada. The second reason was oil and gas. And a large part of our productivity story is based on business investment in oil and gas, which goes through boom and bust periods. And that is precisely what we have seen. In fact, you could argue that because of the way we measure productivity, which is often heavily reliant on business investment, it is a story of what is happening to the oil and gas industry rather than anything else. But this brings me to my second stream.
That doesn't bode well for the long term.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. You know what doesn't bode well for the long term is just pumping out more, ripping and stripping more carbon and then consuming it. That doesn't bode well for the long term. It depends on what long term we're talking about. An investment.
I thought you economists like to say that in the long term we're all debt.
Well, one of them used to like to say that. And we're speeding up that death rate if we don't do something about oil and gas, apparently, according to the scientists. Anyway, the second part of it is we don't measure productivity well. And there's nobody in my world of economics that would disagree with me about what it is we are measuring when we are measuring productivity, but they always knee-jerk business investment because we treat the economy like it is making stuff and buying stuff when it is mostly making services and buying services. And a great deal of those services have got an injection of digital something in that mix since the mid-1990s, but we don't measure digital. We do not measure the value of data. We do not measure, we do not fully measure it. We do not capture it. We don't even capture e-commerce when it's with Amazon. We have proxies for it. We don't measure what we're doing. So how do we know that productivity is falling? It's falling in the sector of the economy that makes things. Well, duh, it's falling in the United States too. Why? Because they're shipping their production to lower wage jurisdictions. And if you're measuring mostly manufacturing or food production or those sort of things, you are going to see that productivity is falling everywhere because we're looking for cheaper ways of doing things. And the Green Revolution in agriculture was, again, in the 70s. We haven't had a similar burst of agricultural advance for decades. We might, because climate change is forcing new mechanisms of producing food. But right now, that is the moment we are in. And the big change technologically, the big investment for productivity is related to data and intangibles, and we don't measure them. So how do we know that we're worse than we were? How do we know we're not producing more wealth? You know, like, it's crazy making to me when people talk about this as if we are living in the 70s. We are not living in the 70s. It's half a century later, and the world has changed in what it is that generates.
I miss the 70s.
Oh, so do I, man. That's why we talk. I do too. Lots more fun.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Fiscal.
Yeah.
Not one of the people you talk to doesn't say we need to bring in, you know, we need to rein in government. So to whom you're unnamed to protect the innocent. People that say we need to rein in government spending, they are simply saying what people of that world have been saying since 1980. More market, less government is the solution. It goes right back to Reagan saying government
is the problem.
And that's
what you found in Scandinavia, right?
Oh, what do you mean? Oh, this is the tapeworm.
No, you were as I read your article, you said, well, actually, some of the best performing countries on productivity have large public sectors.
Yeah. So when you look at the top performers on not productivity, but GDP per capita, productivity is a little sister to GDP per capita. Everybody wants to win the GDP per capita race. Well, who's at the top of the list? Tax havens, oil exporting juggernauts, and a handful of Nordic countries and Denmark that spend a very large amount per capita on their population. And so that article that I wrote was, let's put the capita back in GDP per capita. It's about the people. It's about the denominator, not the numerator. It's not about GDP. It's about how are you investing in the people to grow the economy, which is why I'm saying if you do not invest in the care economy, you will not get the growth that you could potentially have. Again, the end.
Right. But Freeland has to balance off the real world, the real world of money now and people counting ledgers and saying you're spending this, you're receiving that, versus a very amorphous sense of gain in the long term overspending from spending.
But that's because our mental wallpaper is always about it's about bean counting. Rather than, you know, when you come out of the Second World War and you look what governments did with no money, they weren't bean counting how we're going to pay for it. It's like, this is what people need. They need housing, they need health care, they need unemployment insurance, they need blah, 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 blah. It's not like they did scientific studies. Will it pay for itself? It's like, this is what people need. Let's do it. My parents' generation built the swimming pools and schools and universities and hospitals that the next generation was going to need. They did not say, give us our tax cuts. We are spending too much. We are going to go someplace else and shovel our money someplace else. They didn't have very much money, but they knew that's what the world needed. Our metric for measuring success and need is in dollars and cents, but what we need is more common sense. Oh, my God.
Oh, my. Aren't you getting lyrical today?
Yeah, I'm channeling Mike Harris.
So, you know, my last question about the government's program that's emerging is, it is going to be criticized as being highly politically driven. It is going to be criticized as being good politics and bad policy. It's going to be seen as a government that is spending too much, intruding on a bunch of jurisdictions, all to try to find something that can get it reelected. I don't want you to opine on the success or failure of that political venture, but I do want your opinion about whether that's what you think this is, or whether you think actually they're building toward a viable governing alternative to the low-spending, low-regulation government Poilievre is promising us.
It's good policy. It's necessary politics. And it is not there's no incursion on provinces. They can say no to the money if they don't like the strings. There's no government that needs to take the money. You don't want the money? That's fine. It comes with strings because we're trying to do the same thing across the country. Want to play? Great. Don't want to play? Fine. Like, how is that a jurisdictional issue? It's pretty straightforward. And in terms of necessary politics, we are being fed a false bill of goods that axing the tax, which is the only policy choice we've been given thus far, axing any tax, you ask them, what are you going to do about the fact that renters can't rent? You know, you can't just build your way to a solution. We're losing more affordable rental units than we are building them. What are you going to do about childcare? Are you going to ax that too and give people cash? For what? There's no spaces. And there's certainly no quality spaces.
Do not say it. I'm just warning you, don't say it.
Well, but you can't buy something that doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah.
The idea that cash in your pocket is the only thing they can offer you means they cannot build the world that we need. They can only give you money. Money isn't a metric. It might make you feel better 15 minutes from now, and then look what they did with childcare.
But isn't that what people need? Right? Isn't that what people need right now? I mean, in the middle of an affordability crisis, when food prices have shot through the roof and you're worried about your mortgage and your rent and all that kind of stuff, nobody's asking for a government program. They're asking for more fucking money, aren't they?
Yeah. Do you think these guys are going to be A1, let wages go through the roof, right? What are you going to do about the seniors? What are you going to do about the fact that there's no long-term care homes? So what should the worker do? Should the worker stay at home and take care of their dying, aging parent? Forget about wages. Like, they don't have any answers. They only have money, either cutting your taxes or giving you cash. That is not the way you govern. That is not the way you plan for the first time in our history where we have so few workers to support so many people who are too old, too young, and too sick to work. You need a plan for that that goes beyond money. And so I think what this government is doing right now, and it is in some ways performance art because there's so little money involved, but everything it has said talks to the public imaginary of what is possible when we do things together. The other side really only has it's your money, it's your affordability, it's your taxes. It's got nothing to do with us together and the common problems we are facing. And it's not looking at how other nations are dealing with this. At least this government is saying there are solutions elsewhere. We are looking into it.
I suspect that most Canadians agree with both propositions. Other people should have more. There should be more services. And I need more.
Yeah, 100%. And how are you going to get all of that unless you've got a plan? If you just throw money by cutting taxes, which, by the way, is inflationary, as the Bank of Canada has pointed out, or by giving people more money, by letting them bargain their way to hire. But look, that has never, the Working for Workers platform in Ontario has never been about working for workers. It's been working for developers. It's been working for people that are in the trades. It's been working for police officers. It's been working for the boys, right? And they are fine having those wages go up. But in the area that is growing the fastest, the care economy, it's like, let's suppress those wages. Working for workers only means something when you let workers work and live a life of dignity, not turning to a food bank and not worried about losing their rental apartment because there's no place cheaper to go to. Like, if you don't deal with these problems, money is not the only solution. You need to deal with the problems we are all facing. And what you've got here in this pre-budget week is a vision. It is an imaginary that says, here's one way of addressing this. There is another way, which is all about your pocketbook. Full stop. Our way is about your pocketbook, but it's also about our pocketbook. It's about how we do things together. So I think that's a really clear schism. That's why I say it's not good politics or bad politics. It's necessary politics. We need to clarify what the choices are and then let people decide. Do I want that fight? I want that public discourse. I don't want it to be limited to axe the tax is the solution. It's the alternative. Like that's not a discussion. It's a slogan. And it's very easy to be reduced to slogans. Don't get me wrong. But I think there's something about what's going on here that actually brings more of an emotional discussion about why are we doing this. It brings the emotions into it, which you need. It can't just be the head. This is where we started out. Yeah. Our conversation today. It can't just be logic and policy. It has to be, why are we doing this? Because we're in it together. Because we have your back. And they did have our back during the pandemic, right? It wasn't the NDP that had our back. It was the Liberals that had our back. Now, they're asking for a very big gift, which is vote for us again. It's been a long time. But if people decide this is actually the better thing to buy, this is the better candidate for the job, good for them. Because at the moment, in my view, that is the way we're going to get through this, at least begin this incredibly difficult phase of transitioning to a new world order where you cannot live by the nostrum, more market, less government. It won't cut it when more people are not in the workforce. We need more government. And the sooner we wrap our heads around that, the sooner we will have really good discussions about what could that look like from a conservative or a liberal or an NDP perspective. When you need more government, what should government be doing? This is about what is the role of our one democratic institution that we all share in. Elect this person.
I think you and Frances Donald could have a hell of a chat about that, by the way.
Oh, I think that'd be cool. You want to do it?
She has very interesting. I do kind of want to broker it, yeah, because she's got some very interesting thinking along the same lines. Listen, I've only got a few minutes with you left, and I have to talk to you about long-term care.
Okay.
I have to talk to you about long-term care. You've been doing a lot of research into that, what's going on in Ontario, and writing about it. Hopefully people remember the debacle of COVID. Do you know that my brother died in a fucking long-term care home of COVID?
I didn't know. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I also remember how bad those homes were before COVID. Like, they were terrible places to live before COVID. It's not just that they failed in COVID. They were failing before. So, but presumably COVID was a lesson. So presumably there are stronger standards now. And presumably there's more of a focus on care in those homes. And presumably, we learned that the not-for-profit sector provided much better care than the for-profit sector did. So presumably we've learned all those lessons. Is that correct?
No.
Right.
We should have. We didn't. We're rewarding the same firms that had the highest incidence of infection and death by giving them even more public money in Ontario. Five of the six companies that are facing a class action worth over $500 million are getting 78% of the money that the province is doling out to build more long-term care homes, even though they passed legislation in 2020 to shield themselves and these homes from legal action. It is going forward thanks to the Superior Court justice. It's a case of gross negligence, which is an incredibly high hill to climb legally. But that case is going forward because they had the premier called in the military in some of these homes, right? Like, this is like not your average garden variety negligence. This is gross negligence. Anyway, we will see how the courts decide. But my point is, there's something going on there that is extraordinarily odd in how companies that are perform the worst are being rewarded now with more of our taxpayer dollars. And disturbingly, the companies that we are talking about, I said five out of six because the sixth is Chartwell, and Chartwell got out of the long-term care business entirely and moved into, sold their...
You mean formally?
Pardon?
You mean formally? They'd been out of it for a long time, but you mean they formally got out of it?
They actually sold, sorry. Chartwell got out of the business by selling it and focusing on retirement homes. And fascinatingly, there's a story about the people in the retirement homes being given 9 months to get out because they're being renovicted so that they can make more money out of these retirement homes. So they're looking for ways of making money with less labor costs, less responsibilities, and less scrutiny, frankly. And that's the reason why they didn't get money, because they're out. I guess the short answer to your question is, shouldn't we have learned more? Yes, we should have. What have we really learned? There is a revolving door between politics and making money when these people are out of work that pays big. And we're seeing changing rules on letting private equity into the sector. And that is going to, what we have seen in the United Kingdom, in the United States, and in France, is that as private equity moves into the system, they literally wring out any profits they can have and then flip the asset. And the next owner does the same thing.
But that's literally the business model of private equity.
That you hold it for 4 to 7 years. You figure out how to do economies of scale or something, or you reduce labor costs. Do something to reduce costs and increase revenues. And in this case, it will come to lobbying the province for higher fees.
Okay.
And then you sell it to somebody else that does the same thing. Well, in the United States, was it the United States? No, it was the United Kingdom. One player got so big, 20% of the market, that it no longer could afford to pay the debt, because these are, private equity does it by leverage, right? So the company that is making the money has to pay the debt payments, has to pay the lease, which is always another arm of the shell company that is charging exorbitant leases. They folded. 20% of the market folded. It's like, what are you supposed to do with these people? Like, it disappeared like this. Do we have a single guardrail in place in Canada? Absolutely not. We are snoozing our way into disaster.
Okay, so one way out of this mess where we have to trust these pirates to take care of our elders while they're getting rich. Don Drummond on this show asked the question, why are we focused on building more long-term care homes when they're the most expensive way to deliver care to elderly people and nobody wants to live in them? Why are we not shifting our focus in a massive way toward home care?
There are two reasons for this. It's not limited. What we are describing in private equity, and by the way, I made a mistake. This wasn't long-term care that lost 20% of its market with one player going under. It was childcare, and it was in Australia. So I got that confused. But it's happening in home care. It's happening in childcare. It's happening in healthcare. It's happening in primary care. It's happening in the care economy. Why? As the global economy slows, this is one area that is guaranteed to grow because of demographics. So there's money to be made there. If you go in, you reduce labor costs, you increase rental for the real estate, and you lobby for higher fees, right? So there's money to be made. They figured it out. Why haven't we? It doesn't make as much money, so there aren't as many providers, though we are probably going to move more in that direction. And also, not everybody can be treated at home. Yeah, people don't want to move into long-term care, and they don't, unless there's really no options. And we are losing more beds than we are gaining. I wrote a piece 3 weeks ago about how Toronto is losing more long-term care beds than gaining them, because so many of these beds, I mean, you said presumably we know what we have to do after pandemic. Well, a lot of these long-term care homes that were terrible were built 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they housed 3 to 4 people in a room, which is one of the reasons why the incidence was so high.
Yep.
And to be able to renew their license for another 30 years, they have to put in a certain amount of capital investment. to have only two people to a room, to have ventilation, so on and so forth. It's huge capital expenditures. These homes were built in places where they could make millions of dollars instead of spending them by just selling them to condo developers. And so that's what's happening. Yes, we are adding more long-term care homes, but we're also losing them faster than we are building them, which is the same story as in affordable housing. Mm. So he is not wrong that we should have more home care. He is not right, and he is not wrong that people don't want to be in long-term care. We are still going to need long-term care, and we are not doing it in the right way.
Right. But we should facilitate people that want to stay at home. That's even
100%. And most people will do anything they can if they can afford it to stay at home. So we like there are models all over the world how we could improve the way we do home care. And we should be spending much more money on that than long-term care. But we will still, we're going to have the biggest cohort of people that need that kind of care that Ontario has ever seen. And then they're going to die and we won't need that. Well, hopefully not, right? I mean, maid to the rescue, right?
No, exactly. Exactly. If the brain goes, you won't find me anywhere.
Well, you better sign that order before the brain goes, because that's going to be tough for you later on. But I mean, it's the story of the boomers, right? The boomers have written the script through the course of their life. They've always defined how they're going to live, and now they're defining how they're going to die. And I think we're going to see an explosion in that. So Don Drummond might be right, is like, why are we building long-term care homes? But you know, long-term care homes are now counting towards the housing count. How many homes are we building? A bed is now a home, according to the Ontario government. So, you know, I want to be careful.
Don's really smart. I don't want to oversimplify his position. I don't think he was saying that we don't need any long-term care home beds, but he was saying that instead of focusing on building more of those, we should be focusing on home care, which is cheaper and more acceptable to people. So it was just a balance thing that he was talking about.
Cheaper and more labor intensive, and fewer companies want to provide it, and fewer people want to do it. So, you know, like, it's not that he's wrong. It's just that it's not a business model that is hugely attractive. Whereas when you build something, you've got real estate, you've got equity. It's not just a service. It's got capital behind it. You put capital in it and you got capital behind it. So that's one of the reasons why it's gone nuts right now.
Armin, I've abused your time. Took up more of it than I promised you I would. I've loved this conversation. We're not nearly done. So I'm going to have you back, and I think I'm going to invite Francis and see if the three of us can whip this up and come up with a new model.
Well, I would love to talk to you anytime. I love our conversations. They've got a great energy to them, and I just have to be careful not to make mistakes.
Me too. It's with you. Listen, thank you. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. All of you Hurly Burlyites who watched or listened to this episode today, and I want a special thank you to Armin Yelnesian. We'll see you next week with more policy, politics, and the Hurly Burly. See you then, folks. Take care. Hurly Burly. Hurly Burly. Hurly Burly.